proclaiming the gospel to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Shalom and welcome to the Everlasting Nation Broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. I'm Aaron Broughton, your host for today, and I want to thank you for joining me. Over the past few programs, we've been looking at Bible geography by taking a land tour of Israel, visiting special places, both past and present. Now, last time we traveled from the area of the Dead Sea to the Jordan River, and then on to the ancient city, the city of the palm trees, that's Jericho, and this is the same place that Joshua conquered with the children of Israel when they crossed over into Canaan. From there, we visited the Inn of the Good Samaritan, and then on to the fortress called the Herodium. Before we ascend up to Jerusalem, we visited the little town of Bethlehem, where we saw the tomb of Rachel, as well as Manger Square, where traditionally is held that Jesus was born. We finished our day standing on the Mount of Olives, where we had a majestic view of the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a special city that means city of peace, or literally to see peace. One could spend a month touring this city and not even begin to reach the depth of learning about this city. Today, I would like to look at how Jerusalem sits in its location and why this is important. The book of Psalms, chapter 125, verse 2 says, "As the mountains are around Jerusalem, so the Lord is round about his people, from henceforth even forever." This paints for us an important picture for us as we understand the layout of the city of Jerusalem. The basic idea of this passage is that the Lord will secure this city and its inhabitants by keeping his covenant. Isaiah 54 reminds us that even if the hills are removed, God's promises and covenant with Israel will remain. This is a wonderful promise of true and lasting peace. The image of the mountains around Jerusalem is not just a mere example, but is a physical reality as well. Jerusalem is surrounded by mountains. Let's look at five of these mountains in particular. Each of these mountains has a special meaning and amazing history behind them. Each mountain provides a different and unique angle in regards to the story of Jerusalem. Let's start from where we are right now on the Mount of Olives. You will notice that there is a Jewish cemetery right in front of us. You can also see, if you look around, that we are in an Arab neighborhood. The Jewish cemetery has been here since the times of Jesus and perhaps even earlier. The reason is that they hope that the dead will rise here when the Messiah will return. Interestingly enough, Jesus the Messiah ascended into heaven from this place and will one day return in like manner according to Acts chapter 1. Now we will head a little north to Mount Scopus. This mountain is not recorded in the Bible, but has an interesting history behind it. You see, this is where Titus, the Roman general, encamped during the fall of Jerusalem in the year 70 AD when the temple was destroyed. Today, Hebrew University rests with a commanding view over the old city. Now we turn our attention to Mount Zion by looking south. Psalm 48 verses 1 and 2 says, "Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised, in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth, is Mount Zion, on the sides of the north, the city of the great king." Here is where King David is traditionally buried, and where the upper room of the Last Supper is here as well. Next, we look at Mount Moriah, where the Temple Mount is today. This is the spot where Abraham tried to offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice until the angel stopped him. Last of all, we looked at Mount Calvary, where the Lord was crucified. Each mountain tells a story of God's judgment, mercy, and redemption with a hopeful look to the future. Truly, the mountains around Jerusalem puts an image in our mind concerning places that we've only read about in the Bible. It is definitely a favorite of mine, as well as for many other pilgrims who come to the Holy Land. From ancient history to the current people and even future events, there is something to learn and appreciate at every turn. I invite you to join us again next time as we will visit the gates of the old city of Jerusalem in our tour of Bible geography in the land of Israel. The next stop on our journey is Jaffa Gate. Come along with us and invite a friend as well. Also, I just wanted to mention that IBJM is actually hosting a special Bible study tour to Israel this coming March. I invite you to contact us here at IBJM for more information. Now, with this in mind, let's now open our Bible in our hearts as we study together with our teacher and Jewish believer, Brother Mark Oshman.
Welcome to another Bible study. We have been looking at the names and titles of God. In this session, we'll look at several additional compound names. with the word God in them. One of the most prominent of these names to appear throughout the Old Testament is Elohim Tzvaoth, translated as the Lord of Hosts. The Hebrew noun Tzvaoth is a plural form of another noun, Tzva. That word denoted an organized arrangement of forces, usually military in nature. Sometimes, though, Tzva applied to heavenly bodies. Take, for example, the reference in Deuteronomy chapter 4, in which God warned the Jews against worshiping the sun, moon, and stars, or the hosts of heaven. The 34th chapter of Isaiah referred to the impending dissolution of those hosts. Numbers chapter 4 often used Tzva to describe the company of Levites. When setting the parameters for the length of the Levitical period of service, we read that God ordained, quote, from 30 years old and upward, even unto 50 years old, all that enter into the host, Tzva, to do the work in the tabernacle of the congregation. On other occasions, Tzva appeared to connection with military forces. In Numbers chapter 1, God commanded Moses to take a census of the Israelites, particularly in connection with those who were able to go to war. Moses alluded to the Israelite men of war, using the Hebrew term Anshei HaTzva. Moses alluded to the Israelite men of war in the 31st chapter of Numbers. The word Tzvaoth occurs in this latter sense with reference to God as the commander of a military host. The purpose of this usage was to depict him as a potentate, capable of enforcing his dictates upon any and everyone who might resist. The French leader Napoleon once opined that God was on the side of the big battalions. However, the Bible taught that God's battalions are big because of their leader, and not vice versa. God appeared in the Old Testament in a number of ways. Elohim Tzvaoth, Yahweh, Elohim Tzvaoth, and Yahweh Tzvaoth, all of them indicating the Lord of Hosts or the Lord of Forces. The title Elohim Tzvaoth appeared in the 80th Psalm, quote, "Return, we beseech thee, O God of Hosts," unquote. In that connection, the author appealed to God to show his favor towards Israel. Yahweh Elohim Tzvaoth occurred in Psalm 59 with regard to that author's cry for God to execute his judgment on the heathen nations. Both titles showed their writer's recognition of God's sovereign power. The expression Yahweh Tzvaoth was the most common title ascribed to God as a leader of forces. Though that expression never appeared in the first five books of the Old Testament, it popped up frequently in the later prophetic writings. For example, the prophet Haggai used the phrase Yahweh Tzvaoth on 12 separate occasions within two chapters of his book. One of the first appearances of that title was in the fifth chapter of Joshua. As Joshua looked at Jericho, he saw an unidentified figure standing over against him. He asked whether that person was for the Israelites or against them. However, that person replied, quote, "Nay, but as captain of the host of the Lord, Tzvaoth Yahweh, as captain of the host of the Lord am I now come," unquote. Joshua realized that he had addressed none other than God himself and fell on his face to earth in worship. God used the expression Yahweh Tzvaoth in the seventh chapter of Jeremiah when he told the Jewish people, quote, "Thus saith the Lord of Hosts, Yahweh Tzvaoth, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place," unquote. He wanted Jeremiah's compatriots to be aware of his right as their sovereign to call them to repentance. In the second chapter of Haggai's prophecy, God employed the same title in a well-known passage connected with the coming of Messiah. Quote, "And I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of Hosts, Yahweh Tzvaoth." Haggai's generation originally neglected to rebuild their temple. After God chastised them for their failure, they set themselves to perform that task. When they completed that job, some elderly Jews had wept because they thought that the latter building lacked the splendor of the former one. God informed them that this rebuilt temple would have even greater glory than the former one did. By using the title Yahweh Tzvaoth, God emphasized that he had the power to perform what he promised to do. We now look at another phrase, Yahweh Jireh, The word Jireh comes from the Hebrew word yara, meaning to see. The word could denote seeing about something in the sense of making provision for it in advance. In Exodus chapter 39, which dealt with Joseph's time in the Egyptian prison, the narrative in the 39th chapter of Genesis, which dealt with Joseph's time in the Egyptian prison, used the words in that event. Quote, "The keeper of the prison looked, yara, not to anything that was under his, that is Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him, and that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper," unquote. The title, Yahweh Jireh, appeared in the 22nd chapter of Genesis. God prevented Abraham from offering up his son Isaac as a burnt offering on Mount Moriah. Instead, Abraham sacrificed a ram that he found caught in a thicket. That animal served as a substitute for the intended victim and fulfilled Abraham's earlier promise to Isaac that God would provide himself a lamb. That patriarch called the location of the sacrifice Yahweh Jireh, as a memorial to God, who had not only given him a sacrifice to offer, but, as it were, gave his son back to him. Henceforth, those who came to that location would remember that God was able to meet the needs of his people. Then another term appeared in the Old Testament, Yahweh Rophe. The word Rophe denoted from a Hebrew verb that indicated healing. This curative effect could take place in a number of different realms. One of the primary uses for the Hebrew term, rapha, to heal, related to curative powers in the physical realm. In Numbers chapter 12, Moses petitioned God on behalf of his sister Miriam, whom God had afflicted with leprosy. God told Isaiah in the 20th chapter of 2 Kings that he should inform Hezekiah that he, God, had cured him of his ailment. The author of Psalm 103 praised God as one who, in his words, quote, "healeth, rapha, healeth all our diseases," unquote. However, the term rapha could also refer to emotional or even spiritual healing. In Psalm 41, David asked God to, quote, "heal, rapha, my soul, for I have sinned against thee," unquote. In the third chapter of Jeremiah, God petitioned the prophet's contemporaries to return unto him. And he promised to, quote, "heal, rapha, heal your backslidings." God used that same Hebrew term in a similar sense in Hosea chapter 7. Quote, "When I would have healed, rapha, when I would have healed Israel, then the iniquity of Ephraim was discovered, and the wickedness of Samaria," unquote. The title Yahweh Rapha occurred in the 15th chapter of Exodus, before God gave his law to the Jews. When they complained of thirst, he sweetened the waters of Marah so that they could partake of them. On that occasion, he said, quote, "If thou wilt diligently hark to the voice of the Lord thy God, and will do that which is right in his sight, and will give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee, which I have brought upon the Egyptians. For I am Yahweh Rapha, the Lord that healeth thee." The context suggested that God healed the Israelites in a number of ways. In the physical realm, he enabled them to slake their thirst. Without fresh water to drink, they would have died. Yet another element came into play in the same setting. God alluded to the diseases which he put on the Egyptians. This pointed back to the plagues he sent upon that people. To be sure, these plagues had consequences in the physical realm. But first and foremost, God performed his miracles in Egypt as judgments upon their society, especially upon their deities. By using this occasion to slake the thirst of the Israelites, God impressed upon them his demand that they render him their total obedience. If they did so, they would remain free of the afflictions God visited upon the Egyptians. If they worship false deities, God would treat them as he treated the Egyptians. This concludes another segment of our radio broadcast. We invite you to return for more programs dealing with the names and titles of God.
You've been listening to the Everlasting Nation Broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. For more information, you can write us at P.O. Box 1386, Hickson, Tennessee, 37343, or call us at 423-876-8150, or you may also go online at ibjm.org. Until next time, may God bless and shalom.